Hello, this is Andy Bobick, and welcome to another Mojo Music, where I'll be reading articles from Mojo Magazine, along with playing snippets of music. Please let Sun Sounds Radio know if you enjoyed today's program or how it could be improved. Okay, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to read articles from the April 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine. And if you're a big Genesis fan, today is your lucky day. I'm going to read the cover story about the 50th anniversary of The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. And that should take up most of the time. And then we'll finish the program with a classic album review of First Take by Roberta Flack. And the article about the band Genesis is titled Alpha and Omega. Eccentric, theatrical, obtruse, Genesis battled industry indifference, audience bafflement, and eternal rivalry to make music they variously describe as a Venn diagram and a blanc menage. As their final collaboration, 1974's The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway, enjoys a 50th anniversary reboot, the classic lineup of Gabriel, Hackett, Banks, Collins, and Rutherford reconvene to reveal what really went on beneath the Testlicher costumes and public school reserve. Secretly, we wanted to have hits, they tell Mark Blake. The field has changed, but the battle remains the same, a conflict dating back to when Harold Wilson first became Prime Minister and the Beatles' She Loves You was ringing out of transistor radios, has continued up to the modern day. Given the chance, Genesis's former vocalist, Peter Gabriel, and his old school friend and keyboard player, Tony Banks, will try and thrash the living daylights out of each other at table tennis. We both still care very much about winning, says Banks, cozy at home in rural Surrey. On a January morning as wintry as the cover of Genesis's Wind and Withering LP. Neither of us are very good at ping pong, but it's just part of our relationship. Every time Peter and I meet, we slot back into our close friendship and our close rivalry. The pair have revised this complex alliance to oversee a 50th anniversary box set of Genesis's 1974 album, The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. It's the first release since a 2022 farewell tour by the trio of Banks, bassist guitarist Mike Rutherford, and vocalist drummer Phil Collins. Half a century ago, however, Genesis were Banks, Gabriel, Collins, Rutherford, and guitarist Steve Hackett, a group who merged folk and art rock, Americana with classical music, and spun their gothic horror and sci-fi inspired lyrics into a surreally inventive show to rival Bowie's Ziggy Stardust or Alice Cooper's Snakes and Guillotines. A few days later, Peter Gabriel picks up the story by telephone from West London. The soft timbre of his voice is instantly recognizable. Peter Gabriel couldn't sound more like Peter Gabriel if he broke into the opening verse of his solo hit, Sledgehammer. And here's a little bit of that song, Sledgehammer by Peter Gabriel. Steam train. needed something to take our heads somewhere else before going on stage, he purrs. Table tennis was one thing, riding bicycles was another, and then I saw Roger Daltrey leave having a massage. So ever since then, I've always had a massage before a show. You must excuse me, he adds. I do get easily diverted. After months of volleying mixes back and forth, Gabriel and Banks met at the former's Real World Studios in Wiltshire to hear the final mix of what the New York Times once called the Ulysses of concept albums. And I was amazed, says Banks. It took me right back down memory lane. The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway embodies 70s rock in all its epic grandeur, but inside beats the dark heart found in much of Genesis's early work. It marked the end of Gabriel's tenure in the band, the beginning of the Collins era, and a spur for both their divergent solo careers. It's an album that refuses to die, offers Gabriel, but when we made it, there was a sense that the times were changing, and I was searching for something that was a little more, shall we say, relevant to the real world. In 1969, a booker at the Marquis Martin Agency in Wardrow Street told Genesis to give up. He spoke to us for an hour about why we would never make it in the music business, recounts Gabriel. This was partly because most of us came from public school. So I think the feeling was we're not going to help these silver-spooned, toffee-nosed buggers. However, Gabriel, Banks, and Rutherford had grown a collectively thick skin while boarding at Charterhouse in Godalming, Surrey. Gabriel later recalled his first night in a new dormitory. The air was full of the sounds of other boys, either crying or masturbating or both. Peter and I were both quite shy, says Banks, who studied classical piano, while Gabriel sang and played drums. Music coaxed them out of their shells, and in the spring of 1965, the pair joined their first group, The Garden Wall, whose repertoire included Percy Sledge's When a Man Loves a Woman. Black culture was where it was at, says Gabriel. Music for me was about making you feel. So I was listening to Nina Simone and Otis Redding's Otis Blue. In Genesis, the blues and soul sort of got buried under the classical and church influences. Most Saturdays, Gabriel and Banks made a pilgrimage to Record Corner in Godalming, where we'd buy whatever singles we could afford with our pocket money, recalls Gabriel. And one week, Tony, who wouldn't normally have picked up on such a new thing, came back with an early David Bowie single, 1966's Can't Help Thinking About Me. In March 1970, Genesis and Bowie's group, The Hype, played the Atomic Sunrise Festival at the Roundhouse in London. Footage from the show proves that there's something of Oscar Wilde's Dorian Gray about Tony Banks. Whether performing at a hippie love-in or Genesis' final concert at the O2 in 2022, the keyboardist always seemed to wear the same look of stern concentration, like a conductor permanently listening out for a bum note. No, Tony Banks has never changed, confirms Mike Rutherford, ensconced in his West Sussex estate, sounding brisk and breezy. The son of a naval captain, Rutherford is aware of how different his life has been from previous generations of his line. At 21, my father's sinking the Bismarck, and I've got long hair and a double neck guitar. Rutherford joined the Garden Wall's rivals, the Annon, in defiance of a house master who banned him from playing guitar and once dragged him out of the common room for spinning Sergeant Pepper after hours. By 1967, Banks, Gabriel, and Rutherford had formed a new group with their friend and guitarist Anthony Phillips. The whole band like Tomla Motown, recalls Rutherford, but you couldn't hear it in what we were doing. I think over the years, we relaxed a bit as musicians, and it started to come out. One evening after lights out, Rutherford snuck off to London to watch neoclassical rockers The Nice at the Marquee, and Gabriel attended an all-nighter at the underground club Electric Garden. The group were soon writing songs that reflected what Rutherford calls this cultural and social change. When songwriters/producer Jonathan King discovered them on a visit to his alma mater in 1968. King christened the band Genesis, told them to write some pop songs instead of a day in the life type pieces they were stockpiling, and signed them to Decca before they'd finished their studies. I think secretly we wanted to have hits, says Banks. They recorded a single, The Silent Sun, and a debut album, 69's, From Genesis to Revelation. Neither successful. Meanwhile, they burned through drummers. Chris Stewart, then John Silver, then John Mayhew, and ventured out in a converted bread van to support Fairfort Convention or Caravan, but nobody took much notice. We were resilient, though, says Gabriel. Jonathan King's interest soon dwindled, so Gabriel started pitching to record companies on the band's behalf. I became the salesman, because the others would never deign to do so. In March 1970, Genesis began a Tuesday night residency upstairs at Ronnie Scott's in Soho, usually playing to about half a dozen people whom we all knew by name, says Banks, but we'd played with Rare Bird, who were on Charisma Records, and introduced us to their producer, John Anthony, who was impressed enough by us to get Strat to come along. Strat was Tony Stratton Smith, whose Charisma label housed Lindstfarm and Van de Graaff Generator, the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, and later Monty Python's Flying Circus. Genesis signed to Charisma and recorded their second LP, Trespass, in a month at Trident Studios. All was not well, though. Phillips had been suffering with glandular fever, was now experiencing stage fright, and quit 3 months before the album's release in July 1970. And Phillips was the most important person in Genesis, states Rutherford. He was the one that kept us going, and when he left, I think we all thought it was probably time to stop. Then we thought again. Phillips's departure encouraged the others to collaborate and fire John Mayhew, who was a better carpenter. He'd even partitioned the bread van, Then he was a drummer. In summer 1970, a young hopeful answered Stratt's Musicians Wanted ad in Melody Maker, which is how Phil Collins ended up paddling in the Gabriel family's swimming pool in just his Y fronts, waiting to audition for the group that would change his life. "Don't ask me, I'm just the drummer," replied Collins. When asked to explain The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway in 1974. Back then, the idea of just the drummer, becoming the lead singer and a solo pop star, was unthinkable. In 2025, for health reasons, Collins no longer plays the drums and sang sitting down on Genesis's last tour. However, his quick wit is soon apparent after calling Mojo from New York. "Now, you're not a public school boy, are you?" he inquires. "No." They were all a bit bottled up, you see. Collins grew up in Hounslow, West London, briefly appeared in A Hard Day's Night, and played the Artful Dodger in two West End runs of Oliver, before his voice broke. He'd also played drums in several underperforming groups before answering Genesis's ad and knew Tony Stratton Smith. "Strat told me they're a fussy bunch." Once he'd dried off from the swimming pool, Collins parked himself behind the kit in the Gabriel's living room. "I remember Pete and I especially being very impressed," says Banks. "We were all a bit amateurish, and Phil made it sound good. But he was also funny. Every time we met him, he had another funny story." Steve Hackett arrived in Genesis with a voluminous mustache, dressed head to toe in black, like an art student, and didn't say very much. "Steve, a dark and mysterious character," ponders Banks, laughing. "Steve still maintains that character. As soon as I joined Genesis, I realized the others were different from Phil and I," Hackett tells Mojo Today. "I was a boy from Pimlico, but the others had been through this brutalizing school system designed to produce prime ministers, or, at the very least, a viceroy of India, or someone who could lead the charge of the Light Brigade without flinching." Hackett recalls an evening at the Gabriels where Peter's father, Ralph, an inventor, was so deep in conversation he didn't notice the embers from his pipe had set his shirt alight. Hackett watched as his wife, Edith, silently doused the flames with her apron. "I think some of that was passed from father to son. But I also thought, what a wonderful bunch of eccentrics I've stumbled upon." Playing live with Genesis underlined just how eccentric. "We all sat down on stage," says Hackett, "like a pit orchestra, except for Pete." In his Not Dead Yet, an autobiography, Phil Collins compared Genesis's early music to a blancmange. "Yeah, a blancmange," he reiterates. "It was sort of formless. At my audition, we listened to some of Trespass, and it wasn't one thing or the other. There were harmonies that reminded me of Crosby, Stills, and Nash. But when it was meant to be hard, like on The Knife, it didn't sound like they really meant it." The new recruits helped shape the old songs on stage and new material for the upcoming Nursery Crime in the studio. The musical box weeded pinball wizard style power chords to Gabriel's macabre lyric about a young girl who beheads her brother with a croquet mallet before his ghost returns and tries to have sex with her, while The Return of the Giant Hogweed featured a violent carnivorous plant and The Fountain of Salamex was a homage to Ovid's Metamorphosis. It was a long way from The Beatles or Tom Lemotown, but an honest reflection of nights spent in a school dormitory reading by torchlight. And here's a little bit of the song, The Musical Box, by the band Genesis, from the album Nursery Crime. They didn't really do I Love You, I Miss You, grins Collins. It was more, shall we say, poetic. Sales were slow, but Nursery Crime nudged into the UK top 40 in November 1971. But if you want to do something you believe in, you have to get used to rejection, says Gabriel. Rutherford compares Genesis's music at the time not to a puddling, but to a Venn diagram, where its sometimes conflicting songwriters overlapped. He and Gabriel believe that Supper's Ready, the centerpiece of their fourth album, 1972's Foxtrot, is a perfect example of the process. Gabriel, it's one of the two things from that period that really delivered, along with The Lamb. And here is a little bit of that song, Supper's Ready, by Genesis.
I turn the television off. Sitting beside you, I look into your eyes. As the sound of motor cars fades in the night time, I swear I saw your face change. It didn't seem quite right. And it's hello, babe, with your guardian hair so blue. Hey, my baby, don't you know our love is true? With our eyes, a distance falls around our bodies. Out in the garden, the moon seems very bright. Six saintly shrouded men move across the lawn slowly. The seventh walks in front with a cross held high in hand, and it's, hey babe, your supper's waiting for you. Hey my baby, don't you know our love is true?
Supper's Ready was the ultimate early Genesis song. 20 minutes of overlapping R&B rhythms, acoustic folk and classical piano, and a spoof music hall interlude, succeeded by an Edward Elgar-style fugal finale and lyrics which came to Gabriel in a vivid dream. Too much cheese and hormones, he once told Mojo. It's all very English, says Hackett, and there's an element of church music in there. I remember Tony saying that when they were at school, if things had gone horribly wrong during the day, by the time they were attending evensong, everything was all right. For all its quintessential Britishness, the music now started to find an audience abroad. We started to get popular in Italy, marvels Rutherford. Looking back, I think it was because the music was operatic. They didn't necessarily understand the words, but they understood the emotion. On stage, though, the performance was still lacking. Rutherford and Hackett took so long to tune up between songs that Gabriel began telling surreal Shaggy Dog stories to keep the audience engaged. During long instrumental passages, he'd thrash a tambourine or play along on a bass drum. Collins, and the more enthusiastic he got, the more padding we'd have to put in the drum. In the 80s, Gabriel's solo show featured Lay Your Hands on Me, during which he toppled backwards from the stage and was borne aloft by his audience. But his first attempt with Genesis at Ashbury Friars ended with him plummeting 6 feet and fracturing his ankle. But I didn't mind making a fool of myself, insists Gabriel, because I was so desperate to do anything to keep the band alive. Artist Paul Whitehead's painting for the cover of 1972's Foxtrot album featured a woman in a red dress with a fox's head. Before Genesis's summer 1972 tour, their booking agent, Paul Conroy, suggested to Gabriel they should have someone appear on stage wearing the same outfit. Gabriel decided to do the job himself and had a fox's head made before borrowing one of his wife's Jill's Ossie Clark dresses, which, incredibly, I could just about get into. At Dublin's National Stadium, the singer disappeared during the musical box and returned wearing the ensemble. Peter hadn't told us what he was going to do because he knew we would have objected, says Banks. Collins, no one had questioned why there was a dress hanging up backstage, but I don't recall any big conversation afterwards. Oh, I do, laughs Gabriel. Phil said, impersonates Collins, fuck all this. I just want to be a musician. Pete, I said, yes, but this might allow you to be a musician without having to take another job. A photograph of Gabriel in his new disguise appeared on the front page of Melody Maker, and Foxtrot reached number 15 in the UK albums chart. Gabriel, I thought, ah, maybe we're on to something here. Soon the singer would go further, donning a flower headdress and a geometrical box with glowing eyes during Supper's Ready. Some of it was supposed to be humorous, he says, but maybe more than we intended. During a show at London's Rainbow Theatre, Gabriel ascended on wires during Supper's Ready, only to find himself slowly spinning and unable to stop. What about the competition? Well, I suppose by then Bowie had worn a dress on a record cover, Gabriel says, and I'd seen him in concert. I was a big Bowie fan. However, Rutherford insists Genesis were far too busy touring to pay attention to what theatrical rock acts such as Roxy Music, Queen, or Cockney Rebel were doing. "And I never got the Bowie thing," shrugs Collins. "I went to Dunstable Civic Hall to see what all the fuss was about with Ziggy Stardust. But I've never been a Bowie fan because I was coming from some other place." Collins's taste veered more towards the jazz fusion group Mahavishnu Orchestra, whose drummer Billy Cobham's influence was all over Genesis's next studio release, selling England by the pound. So now you've got a group influenced by everything from Rossini to fusion, laughs Hackett, and a guitarist that has to think like an orchestral player. Everyone is trying to be at least two people now. One oasis to calm was "More Fool Me," sung by Phil Collins. "I used to thrash around on the piano at home," he recalls, "but the idea of writing songs and getting them played in a band never occurred to me. Instead, it was, I know what I like. In Your Wardrobe, that gave Genesis a UK hit single, number 21. Gabriel smuggled his diastic lyric, "Me, I'm just a lawnmower. You can tell me by the way I walk," inside a nursery rhyme chorus, but Genesis refused to appear on Top of the Pops. Here's a little bit of the song, "I Know What I Like," by Genesis.
It's 1 o'clock and time for lunch. Bum-de-dum-de-dum. When the sun beats down, I lie on the bench, I can always hear them talk.
There's always been Ethel. Jacob, wake up, we got a tidy new room now. And then Mr. Lewis, it's at the time that he was out on his own. Over the garden wall, two little lovers, cuckoo to you. Keep them mowing blades sharp.
I saw Fairport Convention during the show, and Simon Nicole had a capo on his guitar. So it was obvious he was miming, recalls Gabriel. I liked that gamesmanship, but because we felt rejected by the music business, we thought doing the show was selling out. Instead, they went back on the road, where Gabriel, dressed as Britannia, during Selling England's Dancing with the Moonlit Night, and at a show in New York's Roxy, inhaled helium before addressing the audience in a squeaky voice. When they laughed, he inhaled some more, being the impetuous fool I am. Gabriel was stricken with hiccups for days until he stood on his head, farted, and burped the gas out, and then came home to write The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. On March 26, 2022, Peter Gabriel watched Genesis' final show at London's O2 Arena. The last song of the night was Carpet Crawlers from The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway. And here's a little bit of that song, Carpet Crawlers.
The wool is soft and warm, gives off some kind of heat. A salamander scurries into flame to be destroyed. Imaginary creatures are trapped in birth on celluloid. The fleas cling to the golden fleece, hoping they'll find peace. Each thought and gesture, a chord in celluloid. There's no hiding in memory, there's no room to hide. The crawlers cover the floor in the red ochre corridor. On my second sight of people, they have more lifeblood than before. They're moving in time to a heavy wooden door, where the needle's eye is winking, closing on the port. The carpet crawlers, he dare call us. We gotta get in to get out. We gotta get in to get out. We gotta get in to get out. There's only one direction.
And I remember spending longer writing that melody than any other, he recalls. I was chopping away at it on a beaten-up old piano in my then-in-law's house in Kensington. Genesis started work on The Lamb in May 1974, based around Gabriel's story of Rail, a Puerto Rican street punk who embarks on a journey of spiritual self-discovery through subterranean New York. Being Genesis, the story still incorporated fantastic creatures and lots of heavily loaded sexual metaphors. But it's fine not to understand or to put your own interpretation on it, says Gabriel, because there were question marks about the story right up until the album's release. As they had for Trespass, Genesis rehearsed in a country pile. Demos are included as a downloadable asset in the new box set. But as insured to hardship as they were by boarding school life, Headley Grange in rural Sussex was a challenge. Rats scuttled freely, and they found a bed with ropes attached and human excrement on the floor. The musical Venn diagram was also looking more complicated. Genesis worked like a frantic tag team, with Gabriel scribbling words in one room and the rest jamming in another. Gabriel wanted to write all the lyrics, but with a tour looming, he handed over some of the responsibility to Banks and Rutherford. In July, the band began recording at Glassplant Manor, a remote farm in Carthenshire. Having lived side by side now for two decades, Banks and Gabriel especially began to clash. The first collision came after the Exorcist director and Genesis fan, William Friedkin, asked Gabriel to join him in Paris to work on film ideas. Gabriel asked the others if they'd put the album on hold for 6 weeks, and they refused. Soon after, Gabriel's wife Jill gave birth to their daughter Anna prematurely. The singer's decision to quit the sessions and visit his family met with resistance. I'm definitely a family-first kind of guy, and this was my first child, and we didn't know if she was going to survive, says Gabriel. So that was my absolute number one priority. Phil had a kid, his stepdaughter Jolie, but the others didn't. They're much more sympathetic in retrospect than they were at the time. When Gabriel told Friendkin he'd consider quitting Genesis, the director withdrew his offer, as he didn't want to break up the band. Gabriel returned, but the mood within the camp had changed. With Tony and Pete being best friends, this had some effect on that relationship, says Collins. From my point of view, it didn't affect the music, but I'm sure if you talk to Tony, he'd have a different take. I never felt quite so good about it, admits Banks. It tainted it a bit for me after that. Compared to what came before, much of The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway had a stripped-back quality, with Gabriel's lyrics about Lenny Bruce and the Ku Klux Klan on Broadway, Melody of 1974, taking it further away from Roman poetry and Old England. Hackett says the music for Fly on a Windshield was inspired by Milos Rose's score for the galley slave scene in 1959's Ben-Hur. Banks cites Rail's Bolero. But the raw, jarring Back in NYC was the antithesis of the earlier bucolic Genesis, while The Waiting Room was a musique concrete experiment that went even more off-piste live, as can be heard in the box set's show from New York's Shrine Auditorium. While overdubbing at Island Studios, Gabriel asked Brian Eno to add sonic effects to his voice on The Grand Parade of Lifeless Packaging and to the instrumental Silent Sorrow in Empty Boats. His contribution was credited as Eno sonification next to Gabriel's written account of Rail's adventures on the LP's gatefold sleeve. And here's some of the song Silent Sorrow in Empty Boats by Genesis. Reminded me a bit of Kurt Vonnegut's Breakfast of Champions, says Banks, but I never thought it was the strongest thing about the album. Released in November 1974, The Lamb peaked at number 10 in the UK, and the band took it on tour. Today, no progressive rock documentary is complete without footage of Gabriel looking like a Doctor Who monster in the pustulant green costume he donned for the Lamb's 8-minute The Colony of Slipper Men. It was the moment the show and Peter Gabriel became bigger than Genesis. And here's a little bit of that song, The Colony of Slipper Men by Genesis. Thank you. tough because Pete got elevated above the group, says Banks. To some extent, that was fair, as he was a great frontman. But people started to presume he also wrote all the music. Gabriel told Genesis he was leaving on November 25, 1974, at a hotel in Cleveland. It came as a surprise to me, insists Collins. I was in my own little world on stage. I'd smoked half a spliff, stick on my headphones, and just play. The singer stuck out another 6 months of dates, a very sad tour of Europe, is how he describes this drawn-out farewell, which didn't sell very well, but he agreed not to announce his departure until the shows were complete. Any regrets? Only that the final show was in France, and I was knowingly doing these last gigs to what seemed to be declining audiences, he says, and it just felt pretty fucked up. Today, all parties accept that Peter Gabriel had outgrown Genesis. Pete was simply moving forward faster than the rest of us, offers Rutherford. Phil Collins became Genesis's new lead vocalist almost by accident. They couldn't find anyone else they liked enough, so he offered to do the job. I honestly thought we could just carry on and be an instrumental group, he laughs. Of course, the others didn't. After making two more albums, 1976's Trick of the Tail and 1977's Wind and Withering, Steve Hackett, struggling to break into the Banks-Rutherford songwriting monopoly, left to concentrate on solo career. Today, he regularly performs 70-era Genesis, including The Lamb, with his solo band. It's weird. He's still playing that stuff, but great that he's carrying the torch, says Banks. Everything I did with Genesis sounds sweeter with the passing of time, says Hackett. The 70s was a great era, but it wasn't about bell bottoms or mustaches. It was about music not being constrained to a 3-minute formula. But with Hackett gone, the remaining trio mastered the 3-minute formula, scoring hits with Invisible Touch, Land of Confusion, and more. People often imply that we plan to go more commercial, says Rutherford, whose Mike and the Mechanics side project also birthed huge sellers. We didn't. We just couldn't write hit singles before, and then we became good at it. In September 1976, Peter Gabriel saw the Sex Pistols at the 100 Club, and I was impressed by their attitude. The music wasn't revolutionary, but it was a different kind of performance. There have been a lot of records sold and table tennis matches won and lost since Gabriel and Genesis parted ways. But the friendship remains. The friendships remain. On the band's farewell tour, Collins usually left straight after the show. On the final night, he stayed behind, and we all had some drinks and a curry, he recalls. As I was going to leave, Tony Banks hugged me, and I don't think he'd ever done that before. I remember thinking how sweet that was. Well, I'm a repressed public school boy, laughs Banks. We didn't do a lot of hugging, so it's not a totally natural gesture. A few years after he left the group, Pete met me and gave me a hug, but it was like a sideways hug, as if he couldn't quite commit. Banks pauses. I'm not terribly comfortable with it, but it's nice if Phil remembers that one time. He's a very special person in my life. And now it's time for the classic album review, and this week it's Roberta Flack's album, First Take. Roberta Flack was a musical prodigy who entered Harvard University at the age of 15. Her debut album, First Take, deserves to be recognized as one of the most influential jazz albums of all time. This landmark 1969 album has mistakenly been labeled by many as belonging to the genre of popular music. When the opening notes of the first track place the performance so strongly in the world of jazz, except that the hit single from the album, The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, destined Roberta Flack to be considered a pop singer. And here's a little bit of that song by Roberta Flack, The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face.
The first time ever I saw thought the sun rose in your eyes, and the moon and the stars were the gifts you. The dark and the endless skies, and the first time ever I kissed.
However, she was a classically trained pianist and singer who worked with some of the finest studio musicians around. Her debut album, First Take, deserves to be recognized as one of the most influential jazz albums of all time. Why jazz? Let's consider the lineup on that album. Roberta Flack on piano, Bucky Pizzarelli on guitar, Ron Carter on bass, and Ray Lucas on drums. As solid a jazz backing as one might assemble for an unknown artist making her first record. Granted, every note on the album was planned and charted. So, if you're a stickler who believes the heart and soul of jazz is improvisation, then you may, like others, classify this recording as pop or rhythm and blues. Perhaps you may simply come around to thinking the record defies categorization, as does Roberta. A quick word about her background. She was the daughter of a church choir organist and a musical prodigy who entered Howard University at the age of 15. Jazz legend Les McCann heard her sing in a club and brought her to Atlantic Records, the home of Aretha Franklin. With McCain's endorsement came those studio wonders, Pizzarelli, Carter, and more. Her diction, perfect. Her emotion, so heartfelt and touching that some listeners thought her overwrought. Not for this listener. Her choice of material was diverse, challenging, and satisfying. First Take opens with the Eugene McDaniels protest song, Compared to What? And her interpretation of it is a simmering masterpiece. Her rendition of Leonard Cohen's Hey, That's No Way to Say Goodbye brings a wealth of bittersweet resignation that was inherent in the lyric, but never delivered by Cohen, whose vocal range simply wasn't up to the task. Roberta also chose two numbers by a young unknown friend, Donny Hathaway, and both are superb, particularly Trying Times. As for the hit single, The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, was a low-key folk tune written by British folk singer Evan McCall for his future wife, Peggy Seeger. It had also been brilliantly recorded by Gordon Lightfoot on his debut album, but Roberta Flack turned that quiet love song into a slow-burning paean of erotic desire. First Take itself sold rather poorly upon release. Everything changed when film director and jazz aficionado Clint Eastwood decided to use the song in his 1971 movie, Play Mister for Me. The film's success and the song's exposure propelled Roberta to the top of the charts. Subsequently, she won a Grammy Award for Song of the Year and repeated the achievement the following with her version of Killing Me Softly with his song. Never happened before, hasn't happened since. Her influence on others is immense. She brought Brazilian music Elmore Diodato from South America into her 1970s recording sessions. She helped Peebo Bryson break into the R&B mainstream. She has influenced the likes of Alicia Keys, The Fugees, Erykah Badu, D'Angelo, and Lauryn Hill. Some say she invented neo-soul, or the predecessor of that form known as the Quiet Storm. Others claim she reinvented the art song. Her approach can be heard in the likes of Cassandra Wilson and the newest jazz sensation, Samra Joy. And unfortunately, once again, that's all the time that we have for today. Please join me next week when I continue reading articles from the April 2025 issue of Mojo Magazine, an article and interview with Graham Nash, and an article about when the British invasion peaked. Classic album review of the album 2112 by Rush. Until then, this is Andy Bombeck for Mojo Music saying so long and keep rocking.
Light the trail.